broadcasting from the University City.
We are Cambridge 105.
What sparked your passion for cooking?
I have a good appetite and I eat.
I'll often make subtle changes to the next batch of it.
As long as it has room to move around, it's classified as free range.
So my mother gave me a crash course in cookery when I was 16.
I remember sampling this amazing drink, thinking how I've never tasted coffee this good.
Which homemade desserts can be cheaper than shop-bought alternatives?
We want people to feel at home.
Good afternoon, Happy New Year, and thanks to Ian Dayborn for the last 2 hours. And welcome to this, the first flavour of 2016. I'm Matt Bentman.
I'm Ruth Reyes.
And I'm Alan Alder. And today, we look back at the food and drink scene in Cambridge in 2015. And we're bringing you several scintillating snippets. And if they leave you hungry for more, all of our programmes can be found as podcasts on the Cambridge 105 website.
Meanwhile, back in 2015, the street food scene continued to grow. There were some more new cafes to discover, more new cookbooks to enjoy, more gins, more wines, more cooking ideas, some inspired producers, and we were there to find out about the best.
And let's begin with some of those producers. We had interesting features from our various contributors to Flavour in 2015. Chef and food writer Rosie Sykes spoke with producers such as Dingley Dell, Dynamic Organics, Jack's Gelato, Dovecot Bakery. Here's Rosie speaking with Mark Haywood from the pork farmers Dingley Dell.
We were producing an animal that was 25% Duroc in the final carcass. Duroc's a North American breed. As a pure animal, it's not a great producer, but it's great in terms of taste. We got involved with these guys. They have a development kitchen up in Yorkshire, and they have a trained taste panel. They've got 25 people who've been chosen for their palates, and they do blind tastings under scientific protocols. We cut, I believe it was 90 pigs, so there was 30 of our normal production, 30 of the Duroc line and 30 of the other line. We took two chops, or I think the three chops, from the rib end of every loin, and then the whole lot went through the taste testing and came back and said that the Duroc line, or what we would term the black pork, more tender, more juicy, more taste. We also sent about 10 samples into some of the top-end food businesses we work with in London, and then we sent 10 samples into sort of your more gastropub type people. Positive feedback from absolutely everything. We then repeated the whole process again, so it took another 9 months, and then decided that this is what we're going to do, and that's exactly what we've done. And we have been producing a limited amount of what we would term this black pork, but you know, everything leaving this farm in a couple of weeks' time will be the black pork.
What is it, do you think, is it the marbling that has made the difference to the taste, or...?
It's well documented that the more Duroc you put in the carcass, the better taste you're going to get. We're obviously producing an animal now that's 75% Duroc. We're pretty sure there's nobody in Europe or the States doing that, the level of Duroc we're running at. We've got marbling of about 4-4.5% in it, whereas your normal commercial pork or your standard sort of pork would be running at about 1%, which is going to give you a better tasting experience, a better eating experience, certainly more tender. It's what you want for cooking. You want that intramuscular fat, that marbling.
And Rosie also spoke with biodynamic organic grower Tyler Cotton, who grows his produce on part of the farm at Burwash. She asked him about the more unusual items he grows.
Some other things to mention would be crystal lemon cucumbers, which I'm hoping to grow. They are a round yellow cucumber that I can grow outside. I'm also a member of the Garden Organic Heritage Seed Library, and I've been allocated some heritage seed from them, which I'm hoping to raise some of those. One or two of those varieties are interesting. Tomato, buffalo horn tomato, which is in the shape of a buffalo horn.
Amazing,
yeah.
Wow. So what sort of quantity would you be given of those kind of seeds?
Oh, not much at all. So I think I've maybe got 20 or 30 of an interesting type of cucumber, the buffalo tomato, something similar. So not much at all. Some of the modern varieties are obviously very good, you know, and there's certainly a place for them, heavy cropping, disease resistance and all that kind of thing. But then also heritage varieties are so interesting and tasty, and some of them are quite disease resistant as well, others not so. But it's good to try and keep the variety going.
Absolutely,
you know?
And it's the flavour. I mean, a lot of people say, and that's certainly one thing with biodynamics, is people are always blown away by the flavour. So it's very, very interesting. And Tyler, where might we be able to buy some of your wonderful produce?
Well, the main place that I sell my stuff is to the Cambridge Organic Food Company for their vegetable box schemes. So if you wanted to get my stuff, you'd have a very good chance of getting it through them. I also sell it at the larder at Burwash Manor that's owned by Mike, who rents me my field very kindly. So that's the first place, really, that you can go into a shop and pick it up.
That was Tyler Cotton from Dynamic Organics. You can buy Dingley Dell pork in Cambridge at the Art of Meats in Arbury Court, Histon Chop House in Histon, the Gogmagog Farm Shop in Shelford Bottom, and Cousins in Grantchester Street in Newnham. Dynamic Organics supply the larder at Burwash Manor, the Cofco Box Scheme, the Cambridge Food Assembly, about which more later, and Bridges in Bridge Street. And amongst the other local producers Rosie Sykes spoke with were Jack von Prague, who puts the Jack into Jack's Gelato, and Chris from Dovecote Bakery.
And what has been your most popular flavour this year, Jack?
That would be a close call between strawberries and cream and Earl Grey and plum sorbet.
Extra virgin olive oil is one of my favourites. Are you still making that?
Still making extra virgin olive oil. I did a couple of variations. Did with extra virgin olive oil base and then with some candied orange peel and some pine nuts. And that was quite delicious.
Oh, my goodness.
And one again with some smoked sea salt crystals and olive oil base. I work on new flavours throughout the year just as ideas come to me, but lots of them I kind of have to write down and put on hold and wait until the autumn and the winter. And
so you've got this lovely unit now. Does that help you to think what other sort of strands, because you said your business is kind of in strands, are there other strands you could add? Have you got thoughts about your future? And
certainly, I mean, I share with Steak and Honour, so we obviously provide each other with inspiration and motivation. You know, we did one event for Eat Cambridge where we threw the doors open and invited people here, and that was lovely, and I think that's something we both want to do again and to do more of. We're just trying to find the time.
And you did pizzas that day, Jack. Is that another strand that you're thinking about?
It is. It got slowed down by the fact that my oven got stolen the next day. But a new oven will be coming at some point. I love a good wood-fired pizza. Good wood-fired pizza.
And what are you going to do with your horse box, Jack? Or two horse boxes? What's the plan? What was the plan?
The plan was... I forget the original plan. It was either to have it as to put a wood-fired oven in there, or just to have it as a little mobile gelateria.
So the empire of Jack's Gelato is going to grow, I can tell, and I think we should watch this space for sure.
Initially, I started with filtered water, but when I came to Cambridge, I even collected condensation from Midsummer Common. That's how my main bread is called Midsummer Common, because of my water collection.
So how did you collect the water?
It was in a very Heath Robinson, but it was basically, I'd seen on the TV a documentary of how you would collect water if you were stranded in the desert, involving plastic and a stone, and I did exactly the same. Collected a couple of litres.
That's incredible.
Yeah. I wanted something that was really authentic, and its provenance was exactly where I lived. And I lived on New Square, and the common was right next door. And so I've called my main range of bread Midsummer after the common.
And do you have a favourite thing to bake, or was there something that you really wanted to develop? Or
one of the things I've been working on was, I came across some information that said a pain de pice was originally a sourdough rye bread that beekeepers would make to use the leftover honey. So it was a rye bread with honey in it, and then they would spice it and every beekeeper had their own pandé piece. And so I've researched that, and I've gone right back. So now it's just made as a cake, but I've made it as a rye bread. That's a sourdough that has, and I've teamed up with a local beekeeper. I was a beekeeper as well, so that's you know, that's where that comes from. To make this amazing rye bread, which is a seasonal thing or festive thing. I'm going to sell it at Christmas time.
Places to find Jack's Gelato at this time of year include theatre events at the Junction, Cherry Hill Chocolates in Ely, and Jack does occasional home deliveries too. If you follow Flavour on Twitter, Flavour105, you can find out when. Dovecot Bakery breads can be bought from the Shelford Deli, Burwash Larder, Daily Bread in Kilmaine Close, the Derby Stores in Derby Street, and Arjuna Whole Foods in Mill Road.
If you like books, writing, fiction, non-fiction, poetry, drama, and chat with authors from Cambridge and beyond, then save the page to bookmark every other Saturday at 1 p.m. with me, Lee Chambers, on Cambridge 105, community radio in your city.
In July, I ventured to the outskirts of Cambridge to pay a visit to Hawthorne Farm, run by Sarah Chandler and her partner Ian, and they make honey.
Right, next, A. A, B.
Well, it's a buzzing thing, isn't it?
How long have you been doing this now?
We've been doing it about 8 years.
Yeah, we did a course at the Cambridge Beekeepers. Mm-hmm. They run every year.
All right, yes.
Plus, if you become a member, you can borrow equipment, so you don't have to buy an expensive extractor. You can just go and borrow them. I've got 32 hives here in total. 10 big colonies, working hives, and the rest are all nukes, which are swarms I've collected. Mm. And when they fill out the frames, I'll transport them into a proper hive.
To go into the apiary, where all the beehives are kept, required a full beekeeper suit. The only thing unprotected was my microphone.
Yeah, it's very stuck.
Oh, wow.
Sorry.
Whoa, I'm being attacked everywhere. Okay, this is a test of your mettle.
Blimey. It's scary, isn't it?
It is scary, yeah. Whew. Now, this honeycomb is so much darker. It's more like a coffee colour.
Yeah, this is an older one, so it's been in there a year or two. So the longer it's in there, the darker it gets because they start building it up with propolis.
Yes.
You know, it makes it harder to work with as well when they start getting a bit darker because you can't see the eggs.
Yeah, normally on a hot day, that's when you choose to come in.
Half of these will be out, that's why you don't want to come in.
Oh, I see. So actually coming here on a cooler day, just after it's been raining, is worse for recording.
Yes.
It's quite intense.
Yeah. Very. They hate this microphone, they hate my hand.
Right, it's only a sting.
But myself and Ian are all tightly suited up here. I feel like there's nowhere that the bees could get through, but you know from experience that the bees will find...
There's a space.
Yeah, we've had one in the veil.
In that suit.
Yeah. I didn't tell you before you went in. But last time I wore that suit, one got in.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, something that starts with A, B.
Honey? Honey starts with A, B.
He's right, you know, Blackadder. Honey does start with a bee. And a flower, too.
Sarah and Ian favour holistic solutions to keep their bees healthy. Sulfur dioxide is used by some people to control the varroa mite pests that tend to nibble off the wings and suck the bees' blood. But it irritates the bees too. At Hawthorne Farm, they've found that icing sugar can achieve the desired effect without this irritation.
The ivy extraction, that's the stuff that you leave for the bees in order to survive the winter.
Yeah. We like to give them a bit of honey back, not just give them loads of sugar. So
you can buy feed from other places, but we kind of want to keep it as pure and natural to them.
Mm.
We tend to just let them have their own feed, which is easier for us and nicer for them.
So with these 30 hives that you have here, Sarah, you produce the honey?
Yes, we produce the honey and we jar it up and we sell it out the front of our holding. We're in Hazlingfield, up Cantilate Road, and yeah, we have two different types of honey at the moment. We have the creamed honey and we have the runny honey. Creamed honey creams because of the rape seed that we have around here. So it goes hard and then we basically heat it up to 40 degrees and then we get like a potato masher and you mash it. And once it's creamed, it's not hard, it's spreadable honey rather than being granulated.
As well as the honey, Hawthorne Farm also sell products made from beeswax and royal jelly. You can check out their wares at hawthornfarm.net.
You're listening to Flavour on Cambridge 105.
We spoke with other producers too, such as Bread on a Bike, whose Alison McTaggart bakes several hundred loaves a week and then delivers them on her bike. Ben Roberts is not a producer, but he sells fish from a van in Grantchester Street on Saturday mornings, and he had some very interesting things to say about that.
And I've looked on your website, you've done an extraordinary variety of breads. Are there any sort of regulars, because that's what people like the most?
It's because I'm working in my home kitchen. It's all sourdough, but the most types of bread I could do to provide enough variety for people was four types. You know, I can fit four tubs of dough on my, or however, multiples of that, but four types of dough in my kitchen. So I always make one whitish sourdough, one wholemeal sourdough, 100% rye, because there's lots of demand for that and can't get it anywhere else. And then there's a special, which can be anything. I don't know that there are favourites. When I look at the numbers of loaves that I'm making and selling, it's fairly equal. I mean, it's great fun to develop bread, and exciting to come up with different breads, to try different things. So I do, from time to time, put on new breads. And each week, I should have said, each week the four breads changes. So it might be the one I've made today, I call a 78. That's a particular type of dough, a white bread. And then there's another one which I call a Romsey Wild, which is a slightly different recipe. And, you know, it would have a different appearance, different slashing and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
So I'm always experimenting with different types of bread. And people seem to like the novelty. You know, what will there be in the email this week? Will it be, you know, a different bread, I guess? Every Thursday I send out an email to everybody on the list, and then they respond with what they would like for the following week. And then, of course, I've got this logistic nightmare of working out, you know, certainly as I got busier, working out how I would, how I deliver them, when I can deliver bread to these people and how I do that.
Right. And have you got many people you deliver to?
At the moment I've got about 300 active customers.
That's incredible. All from a domestic kitchen.
Yes.
Well, the supermarket, the problem they've got is the jack of all trades and master of none. They never get fish anywhere near as fresh as I do, and the majority of it's frozen. And it drives me mad that if you go up there and it's got fresh fish, and it's three quarters of it's frozen fish.
Right.
And it is. And I've known fish all my life, and I can go up and tell you where it was caught and when it was caught and how it was caught and when it was frozen and who defrosted it, because I know the factory that defrosts it and fillets it. Drives me potty because they class it as fresh fish and it isn't.
Yeah.
And it's misleading people, because they'll go and buy some and think, oh, it's fresh, I'll put it in the freezer, I don't need it this week. And then when they take it out, it's not very good, you know.
Yeah.
It's because it's been frozen twice.
Yeah.
You know, it won't hurt you physically, but it just ruins the fish because it's drying out each time it's frozen. Nearly all of them have it. They can't possibly get fresh fish for all of the supermarkets that in the country every week. It's impossible. There isn't enough. We haven't got a fishing industry that will cope with it. So they have to have frozen fish, and they get it from all over the world and defrost it and do it that way. It's the only way they can cover it.
Is there a fish that you really like that you think hasn't really taken on yet and you wonder why?
One of my personal favourites is rockfish, which is a really, really nice fish. It's also called a sea wolf.
Is it what people used to call rock salmon?
No, rock salmon is
dogfish.
That's a huss, yeah. That's a different fish. It's rock eel, I think they used to call it. But it's a white fish. It lives on shellfish. It's got a big head, and it crunches up shellfish, and really, really tasty fish. It's a softer flesh, but it holds together. But the flavour of a lemon sole, but the thickness of like cod and haddock, and it's really nice.
And what's it called again?
It's rockfish, or sea wolf. I think you'll see it on most fishing charts that it comes out.
Right, I'll look out for it.
Yeah.
Okay,
thanks
very much, Ben.
Well, I've been looking out for rockfish, but I haven't found any yet. Anyway, in that sequence, we moved biblically from loaves to fishes, with first Alison McTaggart of Bread on a Bike, and then fishmonger Ben Roberts. If you want to be one of Alison's 300 or more active customers, go to the Bread on a Bike website and just sign up. Ben Roberts' fish van is in Grantchester Street every Saturday morning from 8:30 till 12 or 12:30.
Late January to March is the time for newborn lambs. April, May is kidding season, as in baby goats. Matt waited 2 years to time this feature properly. His watch stopped the first year.
It's the sound of two very hungry baby goats at feeding time.
It's more of a way of life. You're never going to be a millionaire raising goats, you know, but I think they're lovely animals. So long as you're not too uncomfortable about it, they're also very tasty.
Goat meat has taken off in America, where vast ranches are devoting their land to the hardy boar breed. And now they're in the UK, and they're local too.
Today, I'm in a field in Cambridge on a licensed goat farm, talking with Melanie Onura and her husband, John. Melanie, how big is the herd that you have here?
In total, we've got nearly 50 goats, and 25 of them or so are kids, and the rest are the breeding herd. My grandparents farmed back in Norfolk. They had sheep and pigs, geese, arable farming. But yeah, this is my first proper experience farming.
All right, give me a show of hands. How many of you consider yourself commercial goat producers, or that's where your interest lies?
I was in.
You're right.
Big idea.
Good smithies. I think traditionally we've had a strong liking for. We had to go into London to get goat meat. So we opted to get a small holding. I said, let's give it a try and have a few goats, see what it looks like. This was 7 years ago, and here we are now.
Mm. And here's what goat meat tastes like.
Gosh. Well, I would describe it as kind of a deep, gamey lamb flavour. It's very rich, but once it's treated nicely in the kitchen, you know, tender cooking, it's a really lovely, lovely meat. I wish more people would try it.
And tender is the key word here. The meat from kids is high in protein and iron, with apparently less than 40% saturated fat than chicken even. I presume that's chicken with the skin on. But the fat has flavour and is full of energy. So this is compensated for when you're cooking goat meat by cooking it slowly, by braising it to retain that flavour, not to reduce it.
Yes, I'll say that's quite right. Mm. But the goats that go to the butchers when they're kids still do have a lovely flavour. Mm. Tender, not too fatty, very good for steaks.
There's been a strong public response for goat meat, and I think even John and Melanie were surprised.
When this all started and went online, we just couldn't keep up with the demand for fresh goat meat. But it is there, it is there. Lots of people travelling overseas and want to come back home and try out their experiences in, you know, North Africa and Caribbean. Where I come from, Nigeria, lamb is a more high-profile meat. Goat is more of a traditional staple meat. Much easier, much hardier animals.
Other vendors in the city have remarked how much more adventurous today's palate is compared to, say, 15 or 20 years ago. Always happy to try new things, international things.
There's a waiting list for fresh. People want it fresh. That really is where the flavour is and the future of the business. You know. Maybe at one day, Anglia Farm Shop will be synonymous with good goat meat. That is a hope for the future. Yeah? You see the sign of a goat when you hear Anglia Farm Shop.
Melanie and John Onura are planning to move to larger premises and a more fully integrated farm with feeding and processing facilities, assuming everything goes to plan. And you can find out more about them and place orders via their website, angliafarmshop.co.uk.
Last year saw street food explode, but gone are the days where it meant questionable meats and unknown ingredients. Here are Alex and Becky of Holy Schnitzels, telling us about their schnitzels and where they come from.
Well, the schnitzels came about really for, I guess, our passion for going over to Austria. Through eating a lot of Austrian cuisine, we thought, well, why isn't anybody doing this over here in the UK? Now, there are a few more established restaurants now out there, but there was nobody in street food that was doing something like this. And we thought, this is a perfect opportunity to offer another hot-filled alternative, or hot-filled sandwich alternative to burgers and some of the other things. And we thought, well, let's take the authentic recipes, which my family have handed down to us over the years, and see if we can adapt those to the street food environment, adding a few extra dressings and toppings and using things in traditional ingredients like the Kaiser roll, which we've worked with a local artisan baker to recreate over even here. To also the importance behind sourcing all the products, the meats. Those are all sourced locally.
We've sort of done lots of research and testing and trying out, and we just want to get it out there and hope people enjoy it as much as we do in our family. We're very much focused on it being a family business, and Everything is just really simple, and our children create these schnitzels in their own homes as well. I've taught them how to do it. So it really is, this is like the third generation of original recipes. So yeah, we're really proud of what we do and what we've got to offer, and we just want to share it with a wider audience, really. We've worked really hard at keeping our ingredients local. Our chickens were rescued battery hens, and they literally have a whole orchard to run in, and they're absolutely gorgeous, and that's just in the next village. So yeah, everything is as local as we can possibly get it.
And we've spent a lot of time actually visiting the farmers to really understand, you know, what their ethos is in terms of their breeding, just to get a better idea of who we're dealing with, really, when looking at the food chain.
How did you decide to do this?
We went over and had a meal with our son. He cooked schnitzels, and he said, wouldn't it be great to do a street food van and call it Holy Schnitzels? Well, after much hysteria and laughing, we thought, actually, that's not such a bad idea.
I think almost all of our traders are very conscious about where they source their ingredients, and of course seasonality, which I think makes our little corner of street food very special. Here's Mark Hughes of Provenance Kitchen telling us a bit more about what they do.
But rather than just being a food truck that provides specialised in burgers or one thing, we're actually going to do restaurant quality food brought to you in a food truck. So we'll have a range of products, and it will all be sourced from local farms. So the provenance is very important to us. We'll be using British farms, and all the food will be finished in our wood-fired oven. Always using sustainable and seasonal products. That's the whole point. That's why the menu changes every week.
Brilliant. Why did you decide to start this? Or
what we thought was is that the way restaurants are working nowadays, people want nutritional food, but they don't have time to make it themselves. And a lot of people don't have £30 to spend on going for a restaurant lunch or dinner. And so if once a day, if they're running around looking after the kids or got busy lives, we can actually give them a nutritional plate of food at lunchtime, which then will be good quality, using good local products. Restaurant quality food in a more accessible format and at a cheaper price. That's the idea behind Provenance. We really just think that the way people want to eat is changing, and we want to be part of that.
Another highlight in street food this year was the fact that it was so international. 2015 welcomed Jalan Jalan, a trader in Southeast Asian cuisine. I spoke with Beatrice Brown last winter about her food and what trading in the winter was like. So why Southeast Asian food?
I went away for 6 months of last year to Southeast Asia from Burma all the way through to Indonesia. So when I came back, I've worked in hospitality for all my adult life. And then when I came back, I thought I wanted to give it a try and bring some of the food that I tried out there back to the UK, yeah.
Well, how do you come up with your ideas? Do you just think about your trip to Southeast Asia?
Yes, all of the things that I'm cooking are things that I tried when I was away and that I loved. I'm trying to make them as authentic as I can in the UK, you know, so that's not always this. Larb, for example, which I'm cooking today, when I cooked it in Lao, has buffalo bile in it, which obviously is something that I couldn't acquire here. whether that's a good or bad thing, I'm not sure. It was kind of didn't really. I think it helps the texture. It breaks down the meat a little bit, but it's very bitter, weird taste. They're all things that I tried when I was away. So all of the banh mi are named after places in Vietnam, and then they're kind of inspired. So definitely some of it's made up. Ideas that I have, and then I just kind of adapt them to work, but they're all based on kind of real recipes that I tried on my trip. The laksa is something that's really popular that I had when I was in Borneo, so Sarawak laksa, which is quite unusual, and I got the recipe from a woman who was very reluctant to give me the recipe. It's got about 50 ingredients in it, the paste, and I still think she's holding back on some ingredients. Yeah, it's not quite exactly, she wouldn't give it away, it's like a family secret. But
that's exciting.
Yeah, it's really tasty. It is really, really good. It's quite hard work to make, but it's worth it, definitely. Aww. Yeah.
Which one's your favourite, the banh mi or the laksa?
I think at the moment the laksa, yeah, definitely. I think I'll never get bored. I could eat it every day. Over there it's breakfast, like it's a breakfast meal, so oh, wow. I think we're missing out over here. I'd rather have that than cereal.
How's it doing street food in the winter?
Yeah, so at least the stuff that I'm serving is all quite spicy, so I think it's a good antidote to the winter. But yeah, there have been some very cold mornings, frost on top of the trailer and ice kind of literally melting when I start putting the grill on and stuff. Literally ice kind of melts off the ceiling.
Oh,
so it's been a bit of a roller coaster, but it's been good. Yeah, I wouldn't change it.
And we met Smoking Cow on the market, one of the increasing number of hot food vendors to be found there.
Cool. So what kind of food do you do?
We're called the Smoking Cow because we do all things beef.
Okay.
So we do barbecue pulled beef brisket, and then we do gourmet burgers, which are 100% beef, and that's all locally sourced from butchers around Cambridge. We also offer, actually, corn on the cobs and chips that are cooked in beef dripping, which we know aren't probably the healthiest, but they are the tastiest.
Who needs healthy, really? Come on.
Exactly.
Which one's your favourite? Do you the beef brisket or the
burger?
Yeah,
well, I like the brisket, actually. They're both really good, but I prefer the brisket because it's a bit different. And, I mean, the burgers are, like, 100% beef, and they are really tasty, but you don't get brisket as often when you're out in the markets and that, so it's nice to have something different as well. So, yeah, I'd say that's probably my favourite.
We also welcomed the Cambridge Paella Company this year, and here I speak with Jamie Rice, who's bringing a bit of Spain to the market.
How do you make the paella when you're here on the market?
Well, a lot of the prep is done at home, so the chicken is boxed up and the peppers are chopped, onions chopped, etc, etc. But it's all transported to the market and then cooked in an authentic Valencian paella pan, which we imported from Spain.
Really? What's in the paella you have now?
We have, obviously, we import all our ingredients are authentic. So we get Maratelli rice from Navarra, which is gluten-free. We also have genuine Spanish chorizo, which again is gluten-free. We put chicken, green beans, red peppers, decent chicken stock, saffron, mix of spices, couldn't tell you about. And yeah, just cook it in the pan, and that's generally it.
Brilliant. So what made you decide to do churros and paella?
We love Spanish food. We holiday in Spain regularly. We have Spanish friends as well, who I have to acknowledge have helped me with some of my recipes. Very kind of them. But yeah, we're just passionate about Spanish food. It's one of our favourites. Our kids love it. And we thought, well, why not? We'll give it a go on the market.
And then we headed to the Swiss Alps with Ben Whittaker of Rosistrasse.
Tell us, for those who don't know, what is a rosti?
Well, a rosti is quite a rustic Swiss dish, traditionally made by farmers, you know, literally just from grated potato with no other ingredients. And often at breakfast, they would have that with, you know, perhaps a fried egg on top. As it's developed and got a bit more gastronomic, they've, you know, spinach and fried eggs are particular. We've taken that dish and made a sort of street version of it so that it's, you know, suitable for the way that we're operating our street food gazebo kumban. It makes a really, really scrumptious base to put a wide range of toppings on. So that's what we do. We get the base rosti, which ours are a bit of a souped-up version, so not literally just the grated potato. We've got Appellation Controle Gruyère cheese in there, some cream, seasoning, butter, onion, which makes for a really tasty base. And then we've got a range of the different toppings that we've put on top.
What's your favourite topping?
Oh, my favourite topping is probably the spinach and toasted pine nut one, again with melted Gruyère cheese on top. It's the melted cheese that really makes them, you know, that bit more tasty. Yeah.
Delicious. So why roasty? Why did you choose to do that?
It probably comes originally from holidays in the Swiss Alps, basically touring all over Switzerland. I'm not a skier, but we go in the summertime when, you know, it's really lush and green. There's some great produce there. And, you know, we sampled rostis. I quite often go for city breaks to Bern, which is where the rosti originated from. And, you know, just really loved it there. I wanted to get into the street food scene here in Cambridge. So I was looking also what's being done and what's not being done already. So this seemed like quite a novel and different thing to bring to the streets of Cambridge.
I think Joe from Buffalo Joe's summed up the Cambridge street food scene quite perfectly.
Why Cambridge?
Because I think it's just building up in Cambridge, whereas in London it's not done, but it's very hard to crack the London market, whereas it's exciting times in Cambridge, whereas people are just sort of getting into the street food scene.
You're listening to Flavour on Cambridge 105.
Moving on to pubs and drinks now, my first ever interview for Flavour took place in the Kingston Arms on a dark wintry day. In January, I thought it'd be a good chance to relive those memories and paint some new ones. So here's bar manager Mikey Pearson and head chef Rob Waits.
We're a small backstreet pub. This is a nice old Victorian building. I've got a lovely open fire going. We've actually got two fireplaces, possibly get the second one going shortly because it seems to be dropping in temperature quite rapidly.
It really is. Yeah. Do you still do mulled wine until the new year?
Yeah, very much so, yeah. We've got a soup kettle up on the bar there. We keep going way until the weather clears up and the sun starts coming out, so who knows when that might be.
OK, yeah, my name's Rob White. I'm head chef at the Kingston. I relocated back to Cambridge about 5 years ago. Romsey born and bred, so it was like coming home, really.
Oh, Romsey man.
Yeah. I've been in fine dining restaurants most of my career, but I just love it here. It's great. Every day is different. We've got a lovely customer base, so it's nice actually to get up in the morning and want to come to work, so yeah.
Rob has worked with Gennaro Contaldo and London restaurateur Mark Hicks. In fact, Gennaro even washed his dishes for him on one occasion. Food for thought when ordering at the Kingston Arms.
We had good times, haven't we?
We certainly do. Yeah, the food has definitely gone through the roof since Rob started. It's really made a massive difference.
Every now and again, I cheekily ask him for a bit of an insight to what he's done, because I've always liked to do a bit of cooking myself. But yeah, I think he's clearly got a really good supplier, because there's fresh fish, and nothing on the special stays there very long.
It's that nice thing of not being scared to put anything on. You know, we put rabbit on, we put pig cheeks on at the weekend. You know, we sold out in an hour, so...
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah.
Blimey.
A lot of the people in the area, their food culture has been educated. You know, they're not sort of, oh, God, pig cheeks. I'm not going to eat pig cheeks, you know. That's sort of, oh, we'll try that, you know.
The pub is quite small, but it has a really nice sound atmosphere. The staff are friendly and as knowledgeable about their regulars as they are their guest ales. So, Alice, you work here behind the bar part-time at the Kingston Arms?
Yeah, that's right. Well, I've been here for about 2 years, so I've got to know Steve and Nigel quite well, and they always, like, sit around the bar, so it's always really fun to chat to them. They always have the same thing to drink, so I always know what they're going to drink. I know about their family and their friends. I've met their family, so it's really nice to, you know, come in most days and be able to see them and have a chat with them and always have a laugh with them. Sometimes they try and embarrass you, but it's just part of it.
Many local pubs will feature good offers, and the Kingston is no exception. It has a recession-busting £5 meal. It's been on the menu since 2008. Seasonal dishes and many attractive combinations.
And during the winter months, on a Tuesday night, we have a pie and a pint night, and we offer a couple of pies and a choice of two sides, and that comes with a pint of ale that Mikey writes on the board what he thinks is going to go with it.
I've been to the pie night and I've had the pie, it's very good.
I think the steak night, isn't it? If you order two steaks, you get a free bottle of wine as well.
Yes.
Yeah.
Now I'm going to come to the steak night. You just sold me on that.
And the customers were always ready to sing the Kingston's praises.
Well, the food always reminds me of your grandmother's or mother's home-cooked food. You know, it's got like a sort of real, authentic, non-processed edge to it.
They're steamed vegetables. They're fantastic, really flavoursome. You know, going back to learning a bit more about the chef, you can understand why everything tastes so good.
This is one of the few pubs in Cambridge where you can bring your dog in. I think that actually gives it quite a nice feel as well. It's almost like being in the Cotswolds or, do you know what I mean, or the lakes, you know, Lake District. It's just got, I think it's got that feeling to it.
You know, you've got six or seven fantastic beers at reasonable prices. What more could you ask?
And we're not on commission either.
Many a true story said over a pint, George.
Right, we're going to grab our beers.
OK, nice to meet you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Cheers. All of this.
The Kingston Arms is on Kingston Street. It's just off Mill Road before the bridge on the city side. As a side note, it also has a cat called Bear, and he shares bar management duties with Mikey, and he can also recommend good guest ales. And camera members too, you also get 20p off of any pint of ale there.
A great pub, one of my favourites. Continuing on the drinks theme, we covered the new brewery Calverley's in Hooper Street, which is off Gwydir Street. And this extract really brings out the care and attention to detail that the best independents have.
Sam, can you tell me what you're brewing at the moment?
We're brewing our five-hop bitter.
And it's got five different hops in it.
Yes, it does. Cascade, Simcoe, Galaxy, Centennial and Citra.
The Cascade is for the bittering and the Simcoe and the Galaxy are coming in as the...
For flavour hops. And then we're using Centennial and Citra as late addition
for aroma
and a slight bit of dry hopping as well, just to get a kind of citrusy aftertaste on it.
Right, so quite a lot of thought must have been put into this. This isn't simple stuff, is it?
Yeah, I think what happens is you get experience from using different hops and you think, okay, it'd be nice to use that with that, this with that. And that's how the kind of recipes develop, really.
And they work.
Yeah.
People like them.
Yeah. We've been really pleased with the feedback we've got from the public. And
so where can we go and enjoy your beers?
The Architect is really our brewery tap. And so we've always got our beers on there. We've also got them on all the time at the Plough and Shepworth. Various pubs around Cambridge that any free houses that take them and you'll find during the summer even tide pubs.
We've been following activity around Mitcham's Corner and Chesterton High Street this year as new independents have moved to the area. In September, one such new independent was a company called Thirsty.
We are fortunate enough to have an on-licence as well as an off-licence, so people can drink in and take away. And we will be able to serve wines by the glass. We have a Picpoul de Pinay lined up, which is from the southern part of France, the Languedoc. And we intend to be fully operational, selling wine by the glass in October.
No, we're not doing it already.
Are we? Oh, yes, that's true. Sorry, we're doing it already, but from the bottle. But not Picpoul de Pinay.
Scrap that.
Okay.
Cut.
The idea is to be a new take on the conventional wine shop, and beer shop, and coffee shop. In the shop, the similar flavours sit close together on the shelves. It's kind of like a colour chart for wine.
Mm. Yeah, it looks like an interesting way of laying it out. You kind of start at one end and find something that looks interesting, and yeah, the stuff that's nearby is clearly of a similar kind of ilk.
Traditional wine shops can have a fantastic range of wines, but even as somebody who loves and knows perhaps more than the average about wine, it can be bloody intimidating walking into a shop that's shouting out at you with 800 different voices.
It's about being just that little bit different.
By having a much shorter range of wines, we will never have more than 100 wines on our core range, and splitting that into three categories for white, three categories for red. The idea is to make things much simpler and more accessible for the vast majority of people who are coming out to buy some wine. Did we talk about the growler? The growler filler. Now, growler is a term coined in America for a large bottle. We have a system whereby we can fill a 1 or 2 litre refillable growler bottle with one of up to four craft beers.
Traditional bottles, which you can see with it.
Well, you can't see it on the radio.
Exactly. I thought I'd make a noise so that people could feel it. This is a 2 litre.
You've got a good face for radio. So the growler bottle, we can fill it with one of up to four constantly changing craft beers. We're the only guys, to our knowledge, with this system, which is a system that comes, of all places, from Siberia. We're the only people, I think within about 60 or 70 miles, i.e. from London, who have got this kit. And the beauty of it is, some beers are never even available in bottle or in can. They're only available in keg. So we've got access to those beers. Secondly, the system as it is, it's filling the bottles under pressure. So you're getting the carbonated beer, because they are all, these craft beers, they are all carbonated. We have carbon dioxide out the back, so the beer goes into the bottle under pressure with the correct degree of carbonation.
I've got to turn the gas on first, that would help, wouldn't it?
Wait, you're doing it again. You've got to turn the taps off first.
Thank you. Didn't see that. Right, so you turn the gas on, which is the CO2, and that sparges the front of the air brakes on a truck, pressure being released.
And because we then tap it at the top, it stays good in your fridge for several weeks until you open it, at which point you need to guzzle it up, which is no great hardship. But this is something pretty jolly different. This is, you know, this is great. It's fun, as well as being a completely new way of dispensing and purchasing beer. But that's really at the beginning of its development. And I think we're seeing people are interested in this idea of good quality refill formats, because there's an ecological gain. We're not having to transport lots of heavy glass, whether from France or wherever. And there's an economical gain. Certainly with the wine, there will be 10 to 15% saving on what the equivalent wine would cost if we were to stick it on the shelf in a normal bottle.
Thirsty were very quick to pick up on the Cambridge street food scene. And now, almost every day of the week, you can find a different van outside.
What's that? What? What are you eating?
Hi, my name's Kate from Providence Kitchen. We're outside Thirsty today on Chesterton Road.
I first came here on Wednesday and you had Steak and Honour just turned up. It looks like you've taken advantage of the exploding street food scene that began in Cambridge roughly around about 2 years ago with Food Park. And already it looks like you're having Steak and Honour here on Wednesdays, and right outside the door now we have Providence Kitchen most Saturdays. Matt, you mentioned that as soon as Steak and Honour turned up and they tweeted to all their customers, it just brought a torrent of people here.
Yes, absolutely. I think now that we can serve wine on the premises
and beer,
the food vans are going to be an integral part of that, and we think it's a massive draw.
Yeah, I think there's a nice sort of symbiosis between what we get out of it and what the food trucks and what our joint customers get out of it. So we'll be going after more of that.
Gourmet burgers, vegetarian food and so on. Thirsty is a proper food and drink venue. You can find it at 46 Chesterton Road.
For the newest and best in world and roots music, listen in to Club Global, Music Without Borders, with DJ Skunk fortnightly on Saturdays at 7 p.m. here on Cambridge 105, community radio in your city.
We covered quite a few books last year too, with Sarah Lavelle and Tim Haywood. Here's Sarah talking about her idea for the book Posh Toast, and Tim explaining his ideas on the best type of bread for a bacon butty, and that's from his book, DIY Cook.
And when you were on Flavour last time, you told us about an idea you'd had for a book, and that book has now been published, Posh Toast.
Yes, Posh Toast.
And what was the idea behind it again?
The idea was, I think it's probably about kind of 2 years or 18 months ago, the whole avocado on toast, on sourdough trend really started to kick in, certainly in London. And I kept walking around seeing boards outside cafes and restaurants say, "We serve avocado on toast," charging like huge amounts of money for basically avocado squished on toast. And I thought, interesting, something in it. And, you know, and toast is just a perennial comfort food. It's something that people aren't daunted by. They find it, you know, most people can get their heads
around. People are up to toast.
Yeah, could get their heads around slicing some bread and putting it under the grill or in the toaster. So then I started investigating and discovered that sales of, you know, the really huge toasters, like the big Duelits, had risen massively over the, you know, sort of course of 2013, 2014. So when I came to Quadrille last year, I sort of took that opportunity to get this sort of pretty rough idea off the ground, got a recipe list together and met a brilliant photographer, Louise Hagger, and a home economist who works with her a lot, Emily Kidd. And we just sort of put our heads together and developed this recipe list. Emily came up with the recipes. Louise shot every picture from overhead, so in exactly the same way, but instead of on your traditional plates with all the kind of styling and serviettes and glasses in the background, we just shot it all on paper. So Louise went off to a paper shop, stationery place, and just came back with all these beautiful sheets of paper, and it just gives it a really different, fun look. It's incredibly colourful. We did it a small format, so it's very kind of handy and pick-upable. Pretty much every recipe fits on one page, and every recipe has a picture. And yeah, it's just it's caught the imagination of so many people. Our Australian parent company absolutely love it at the moment. In Australia, are going nuts for it. It's publishing in the US too, on the Chronicle list, and it's been picked up in Brazil and Korea, which I love the idea that I could just come up with this sort of posh toast and people in Korea and Brazil are going to be making the recipes. It's slightly mad.
You've got quite strong views as well, and sometimes iconoclastic views, like bread. Tell us what you think about bread.
Oh, gosh, I mean, I run a bakery. I work with bread every day. It's just there's so much sort of nonsense, really. And we are in a great situation at the moment because there's so much good bread in the UK. We've got some excellent bakers doing tremendous stuff. But everybody seems to have the idea that this fantastically artisanal, open, structured sourdough is tremendous. And when I was researching a chapter on a Vietnamese sandwich called a banh mi. And the banh mi is made by street traders in Vietnam. And it's with a bread roll that's very, very, very similar to a supermarket reheat roll. It's a quite commercial baguette-based thing with a little bit more rice flour in it. And I spent ages online researching and talking to different people, all of whom were trying to make their own authentic street loaf. And I finally got to taste one. It was exactly the same as the one you get reheated in Tesco. So I thought, in a way, that really made me think, you know, if I really, really, really want the really best bacon butty, yeah, I want the bacon to be fantastic, but I want the bread to be doughy and gunge. You know, there's a really good place for that kind of awful. I'm going to eat it once a year, for Pete's sake. It would ruin my digestion otherwise. And there's nothing quite as good as a really, really, really thick, punishing rye bread if you've got exactly the right kind of cheddar to go with it. But that's just going to be... it's going to be ruined with a camembert. So I think we just should just use all of them. And actually, some of the undignified supermarket and commercial breads that we've grown up and we've come to love. So particularly when you're talking about something like a chip butty. Yeah, sourdough chip butty, terrific. But no, that's not going to touch my childhood.
And we got some good advice last year too. Here are Nazima Pathan with some ideas for rhubarb, and that's back in the market now. And then Rosie Sykes and her role as developmental chef for the Pint Shop, whose owners Benny and Rich wanted a sundae on the menu. And finally, we get some growing advice from Dave Fox from Trumpington Allotments.
Yes, so forced rhubarb, it has a slightly more delicate flavour. It's been grown and harvested in the dark so that it has it retains a pink colour and has a slightly more sweetness to it. It's a great thing to use both in savoury and sweet dishes, great accompaniment to game meat such as duck. If you were to make a compote with it, if it was me, I would probably spice it with some star anise and other winter type of spices and then serve it alongside some duck breast, maybe with a red wine reduction.
And anything else that it's good for?
In terms of sweet, obviously, preserving it is a good idea, and both curd or preserves, it'll be a really good way to keep that pink colour. We also like poaching it. Now, one of the things, apart from the usual cinnamon and orange juice, which are great flavours to go with it, is cardamom goes very nicely, and we've done a compote with cardamom and sugar for rhubarb, which we served with a jasmine rice panna cotta, where we cooked the rice in milk and then used that milk, discarded the rice, and used the milk to make a panna cotta, so it had a very nice delicate flavour to go with the sort of sour but slightly warm cardamom flavour of the compote.
Oh, if only you were still doing supper clubs.
Well, there might be one soon, but yeah.
We hope. Any other ideas?
So, and obviously, Nigella Lawson has a great one that I've also done as well, which is to put it instead of a lemon curd tart to make a rhubarb curd tart, and that's delicious, I think.
Tell me about the tea and toast dessert.
So Benny and Rich had told me that they were very keen on sundaes, and so I thought, well, I must try and get Jack's marmalade ice cream on the menu. So I was trying to work out how to get that into a sundae, and I came up with tea and toast because we have a lovely fruit bread here that we serve with the cheese already, so I knew that we had this nice toasted tea bread. I love the flavour of Earl Grey, and I thought there must be some way of incorporating that. So we made this Earl Grey cream, which is just really good Earl Grey tea leaves infused into cream, but cold infused. And the flavour is just absolutely immense and
well,
really
just
surprising.
The dry tea leaves themselves.
Yes, Yeah. And the flavour develops really quickly after about an hour. And it also changes the texture of the cream because of the citric acid in bergamot, I guess. So it becomes quite thick. You do still need to whip it. And we do add a tiny bit of icing sugar because it is slightly bitter. But the combination, there was a chap sitting by me today who says he only ever really eats chocolate puddings. And I said, just try this. and he put his spoon through the cream into the ice cream with a tiny little bit of the toast, and he was away. He was so happy, which made me in turn very happy.
This is an enormous green plant. You don't expect this in the middle of winter. What is it?
Well, I didn't expect it to get quite this large, although it is called tall kale, so I suppose the clue's in the name. It's a large brassica with slightly crinkled leaves, and it's a good 4 to 5 feet high. It's coming up to almost chest height, with a very strong stem that is maybe 6 centimetres diameter.
And really quite woody looking.
Yes, and it's coming up to its second year. So I left it in hoping to collect seed from it. But it hasn't produced any flowers or seed yet. It just carries on producing leaves.
It's bursting with growth and vigour.
It is, and there's some pieces of growth that look like it might be thinking about making a flower spike. And, oh my goodness, what's this? Oh no, I was thinking that was a caterpillar, but it's not. It's just the shape of an immature leaf.
But this is a pretty unusual plant, Dave. I've not seen one of these before.
No, neither had I before I got the seed from the Heritage Seed Library. So I'm a member of Garden Organics Heritage Seed Library, which preserves old and unlisted varieties of vegetables and makes them available to the members.
What does unlisted mean?
Oh, it means that it's not on the national list which regulates the marketing of seed, and one of the consequences of this is the seed can't be sold. So therefore the way the Heritage Seed Library operates is you become a member, and then as part of your membership benefit you get 6 or 7 packets of seed each year which you get to choose from their list. So it's a terrific way of accessing unusual vegetables and old varieties, and just experimenting or having a bit of fun.
Yes.
And I'm very pleased to say that there will be a Heritage Seed Library stall at Trumpington Seedy Sunday.
And they'll have some of their seeds with them to...
Yes, that's right. Yeah, seed will be available there, and it's not for sale, but make a small donation.
Dave Fox there from Trumpington Allotments, and we hope to have more from Dave this year. But back on the subject of books. Writer and broadcaster Andrew Webb kept us all informed and entertained when he looked at a book from his historical bookshelf. Here's an extract from the 1907 book, A Guide to Modern Cookery.
But something of interest to our region here is recipe 133, Cambridge sauce. Pound together the yolks of 6 hard-boiled eggs and the washed and dried fillets of 4 anchovies. Then it says, when the whole forms a fine paste, add tarragon, chives, chervil, capers, a fifth of a pint of oil, vinegar, and proceed as for mayonnaise. Season with a little cayenne, and then put through a sieve, whisk it smooth, and finally finish with 1 teaspoon of chopped parsley. Now, the comment here says, it is suited to cold meats in general. In fact, it is an anglicised version of Vincent sauce. Ooh, get you. So Vincent sauce is above that, and is pretty similar, though it features spinach. But interestingly, also ends with a dessert spoon of Worcestershire sauce. So, I mean, just looking at this, there's a whole section on flavoured butters.
Well, that was Andrew Webb. Food waste and food banks featured prominently in the national news over the year, and on Flavour as well. Food Cycle is a charity working with communities to make sure no good food is ever wasted. In August, we went to St Paul's on Hills Road to attend a Food Cycle dinner. One of the chefs is Flavour's cocktail aficionado, Aoife Maxwell, the first voice you'll hear.
So we've been here, faced with 5 sacks full of food that would have gone to landfill, and we had to come up with a menu. So the 2 Janes have produced a wonderful soup we're about to serve of root vegetables, parsnips, turnips, potatoes, and lots of fresh herbs from the garden here.
We get donations from the farmers outlet on Lensfield Road, a vegetable box every week from Waterland Organics or Cambridge Crop Share. We get a lot of stuff from the Cambridge Fruit and Veg Company as well. We've recently started getting ice cream from Jack's Gelato, which is my personal favourite, and dairy and eggs and all sorts of stuff from Cheese and More, they're called. The first week they delivered stuff to us, we made baked camembert and people loved it. It's always vegetarian food, but never meat or fish, because it's stuff that is getting near to its sell-by date. And you don't really need it, actually. Cooking this way helps you be a bit more inventive.
So what was the main course that day?
Then for main course, we've got chickpea and vegetable hot pot stirring away on the stove. The Janes again have outdone themselves with the potato wedges. Artem has produced a wonderful salad. For dessert, we have Aoife's famous banana and berry muffins with ice cream, some of which donated from Jack's Gelato. So we get all the good stuff around here, and a lovely fresh fruit salad.
Food Cycle is open to everyone. They place an advertising board outside on the day, and that's what drew me in. And that's how I met Diane.
I'm going to start every Saturday now, to meet people, different people, you know, because I'm quite isolated where I live. People don't tend to talk to you. I don't know what they do, I don't want to know, but they're not very friendly. So by being a regular here, I'm getting a little clique of friends, you know. There's always a meal. If you're not here at 12:30, you come at 1:00, you still get a meal, which is good.
It's a great way to make use of food that's still perfectly edible. I had a 3-course meal for £2, and that includes the lovely Jack's Gelato ice cream, and I was stuffed.
You're not having course number 2?
No, because I've got to start going around and recording some more voices.
Yes.
Yeah.
Who can you pick on next? The curate, John Canessa.
Is that he's the guy good. In the dark blue?
Yeah, he's good. Get him.
My name's John Canessa. I'm the curate at the church at St Paul's. We've had the Food Cycle based here for 4 years now. We're looking to become an eco-congregation, so the idea of Food Cycle sits very well with that ethos. Using the food which would otherwise be thrown out just seems to me to be sort of good stewardship.
Absolutely filling. You can't, you know, sometimes you can't even get through it, and it's so healthy now as well.
Food Cycle provides a nice sort of context in which that becomes quite easy and natural to do and doesn't feel like it's sort of adult services or social services officially in here. It's just happening naturally off relationships which just happen because people are sitting together eating.
It's a real blessing because there's some of us that come here and we probably wouldn't be able to eat today if we weren't coming here.
There's also these other benefits, these other sort of social benefits. You know, it's doing a lot of good things gently in the background. I just feel it's a real privilege to be part of all of that.
And a closing comment from Aoife Maxwell.
It went really well today. We actually had quite a full room, as I think you saw. I had lots of compliments on my muffins, so I'm pleased with that. No, and it's just lovely to see so many people enjoying food together. I think that's what the heart of what Food Cycle and here at St Paul's we like to do, you know, enjoying time, talking and eating together.
Food Cycle Cambridge is always happy to take on more volunteers to help with prep and cooking these regular meals at St Paul's on Hills Road. And you can register your interest at foodcycle.org.uk and check their Twitter messages too, at foodcyclecam. That's cam with a B.
Flavour took on another regular reporter this year, the prolific food writer and blogger Pina Broccoli-Anaya. She's recorded features on Cambridge Olive Oil Companies, a Cambridge Food Networking Group, and the new Espresso Library on East Road. Here's two brief extracts from hers, beginning with Chura's Bar Street Food.
How do you come up with the dips that you want to, and do you make them yourself?
We do make our own salted caramel, which my wife makes. She's half French, so she's got the French influence for putting products together.
Yeah, I think the dips are kind of add that little extra touch that make the churros just a little bit more tasty.
With the dips that we do supply, the flavours just burst in your mouth with the churros. So you've got the crunch of the churros, you've got the cake-like consistency on the inside, and a lovely dip to go with the cinnamon and the sugar. And
very good. So what are the other dips that you offer?
Belgian chocolate and amaretto or Bailey's, white chocolate and rum, which is fantastic. And we've done a spiced pumpkin dip.
I had that also, one that was really good.
Which also went down rather well with a lot of people.
In November, Pina visited the recently opened Tradizione Pizzeria on Mill Road. And this is one place I've heard such plaudits for. It's really fitted in well.
So how long has the restaurant been here?
Next 15th of November will be 1 year.
There's always a lot of people here, especially a lot of Italians, so that's always a good sign when the Italians come for Italian food.
We are quite happy. In the pizzeria in Italy, you usually eat only pizza. We decided to add a pasta as well because I think that for the English people, pasta is important. It's an important dish. Obviously, we don't do meat or fish because it's a pizza restaurant.
Yeah.
They are all homemade and handmade. Every ingredient is fresh. If you see on our menu, we have ragù bolognese. A lot of people made bolognese in Cambridge. But I'm not sure that a lot of people cook the bolognese for 5 hours.
Yeah, that's the proper way.
Yeah, we cook it in the proper Italian way.
Sometimes you have specials. I know I'm a big fan of the truffle pizza, and I've been you get them seasonally, so it's really something that people have to ask for.
Yeah, the truffle is something difficult to find, even in Italy. All truffle came from the center of Italy. The truffle is very good, it's very expensive, but we decide to sell it for very, very little amount of money, because you can eat truffle pizza for £15. 1 kilo of truffle costs £300. We sell it as we buy it, you know. I do as an advertisement.
Yeah, and word of mouth gets around when you have something special like that.
Exactly. I think that the word of mouth is the best advertisement you can
do. Yeah. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me, Andrea.
Thank you very much.
Grazie mille.
Grazie
ciao.
A voi.
Ciao. And you're listening to Flavour on Cambridge 105.
Yes, you certainly are. And on now to the Cambridge food and drink news. And the big news this week is that on Wednesday from 5:30 till 7 p.m. at Espresso Library in East Road, there will be the launch of the Cambridge Food Assembly. This is a bit like an endorsed farmers market. You order online at the Cambridge Food Assembly website, and then you go along and get your stuff and meet the producer as well. And the idea was a winner in the BBC Food and Farming Awards. Many producers will have extra items just in case you decide to get something that you didn't order. And the producers this coming week are Dynamic Organics, Sedgwick Charcuterie, Honeyshed Bakery with their cakes, and Wobbly Bottom with their cheeses. There's Cam Cattle and Cam Lamb, Moonbean Foods too, amongst other things. They have raw stone ground chocolate. There's Wild Country Organics. Espresso Library will also be open as usual for food and drink, including their legendary gin and tonic.
Tonight at the Blue Ball in Grantchester is Provenance Kitchen, who will be serving from 6 to 9 p.m. There will be an open fire and Adam's Ales in the pub too.
Also tonight at Thirsty and Chesterton Road, Holy Schnitzels will be there, parked up providing food.
Tomorrow at the Free Press Pub in Prospect Row is the Rockin' Raw Chef.
The new cafe in the Cambridge Cookery School is now open again after Christmas. They do coffees, croissants and cinnamon rolls from their own bakery. They also do lunches and cakes. Open from 8:30 to 3, Monday to Friday. Steak and Honour will be popping up there soon. The cafe is down Harrison Drive, which runs through Homerton College. There's no parking at the moment, so go on your bike.
Michelin-starred Alimentum in Hills Road is offering 10% off to all NHS staff.
On the 21st of January, Hot Numbers in Gwydir Street has Holy Schnitzels.
If you're a gardener, on the 24th of January, Seedy Sunday brings you seed merchants, including the Heritage Seed Library, a seed swap, talks on wildlife gardening, and seeds in the small holder. There will be teas, coffees, and cakes as well. It's at Truppington Village Hall, the 24th of January, from 1:30 to 4 p.m. and costs £2.
And that completes today's programme. We hope you enjoyed this look back at 2015. And remember, you can email us at flavour@cambridge105.fm or follow us on Twitter at flavour105.
And following us this afternoon at 1 o'clock is Bookmark.
This edition of Flavour will be repeated tomorrow at 7 a.m. and an expanded edition will be available as a podcast from early next week. Until our next programme, which is on the 23rd of January, goodbye.
Bye.
Goodbye.
Hello, my name is Diane, and you've been listening to Flavour on Cambridge 105. Oh, I can't wait to hear that. We must have it on the radio next Saturday.